the audience smiling.
We're all alive.
Today, we're lucky enough to have John Horrigan again, who last time he was here, he showed, he gave us the one about the 38 hurricane.
Oh, yeah.
Which was, I thought, was very, I can't remember that as I was a little guy. But today, he's going to talk about the summer that never was, although that's not the title, is it, John?
Well, you're going to see in a second, Dick, there's 100 different titles for this, so that I'll add that one as number 94, so no problem. Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It's great to be here at the Duxbury Senior Center for the Low Vision Group here on this marvelous September morning in 2009. If you look up on the screen, and I know that we have some of you can't see, don't worry, I'll drive the narrative. But I have four objects up there. One's people ice skating on a river, okay? That's a summer scene. You see a volcano. You see sun with some blotches on it, and you see, what's that creature up in the right-hand corner? Anybody?
Frankenstein.
That's Frankenstein. They all factor into what's known as the year without a summer. And what we're referring to is not this year, although I'm going to talk to you about this year. We're talking about the year 18 and 16.
Oh, wow.
Adino Brackett said, talking about the year 1816, "This past summer and fall have been so cold and miserable that I have from despair kept no account of the weather. It could have been nothing but a repetition of frost and drought." And you're going to see that there are a lot of factors involved with the year without a summer. There's three factors, actually, I'll tell you up front. Volcanic eruptions, sunspots, and what's known as inertial solar gravity, or the wobbling of the sun within our solar system. And I'll get to that in a moment. Not going to hit you with some hard scientific data, but I just want to set the scene for the year without a summer, and then I'll read some New England accounts, which I think are fascinating. I think you all know about me. I'm a historian, a folklorist. I study historical fires and historical weather. I belong to a number of historical societies, and I have what's known as the new popular public history. I bring a contemporary and invigorating view to American history with a mission of returning baby boomers to their youth through historical presentations. Now, I must say that I rarely have baby boomers at my historical presentations. People say, why don't you lecture in high schools and elementary schools? I can't even get their parents to come to my lectures. That's not my target audience. This is. Other things, if there is a fire, I will lead you to the fire exit downstairs. Well, you always have to be prepared. So the year without a summer. Dick, you said, what did you say, the summer that wasn't? Well, they called it, if you look through historical chronicles, 1800 and froze to death. The cold summer, it was known as. The poverty year. A lot of drought, a lot of failed crops. The year without summer. The summerless year of 1816. And what I like is 1816 and near froze to death. And then year there was no summer. So not to hit you with a lot of graphs here today, but basically if you look at throughout time, and I like to look at weather from a historical perspective, from 100 years out, from 1,000 years out, just so we can get to understand what this global warming argument is. And I try to tell people both schools are wrong. The Al Gore school are twisting facts, where they're saying that the glacier's going to melt, we're all going to drown within 10 years. Yes, there's pollution. I'll get to that in a moment. But they're to the extreme side. I think global warming is a short-term phenomenon, and you'll see my speech later that I fear global cooling. And then you have the, I'll call them the right-wing industrialists who think it's natural. It's not natural. There's a lot of man-made and artificially induced pollution into the upper atmosphere. I will give you this figure. Since 1989, there are three times as many automobiles on the road as they are today because India and China have been industrialized and all of Southeast Asia. They don't use unleaded gasoline in Russia. More Americans are driving twice as much as they used to. If you look at commercial flights in the last 20 years, they've quadrupled. Okay, so you've got more planes flying with six or seven people in them cross country. So there's more pollution particles being induced into the upper atmosphere. Well, before we get into 1816, there was something known as a medieval warming period, and it took place in, say, from the year 850 or so up until just about the 1300s. And the Little Ice Age began after a warm period during the Middle Ages. And you can see that the graph there, it got cold, and this was not due to pollution. This was a natural phenomenon. That's right. So if you look at the reconstruction of data, and again, I'm not going to throw graphs at you, but basically you can see dips. And if you look at the center of the graph, I'll just show you where it really got cold around the world, was in about 1500s. Now, what I want to show you is that if you look at right here, about 1492, it got warm enough. What happened in 1492? There you go. So I often say that had Columbus, and he went during hurricane season, by the way, and had he been hit by a hurricane and he just missed one, we might have been 100 years away from being discovered, and our ancestors might be Spanish. And that's the Little Ice Age period you see there. So around 1300, warm summers in Europe stopped being dependable. And there are three minima. And what you're going to hear me say minimum, maximum, minima. But basically, cold periods began in 1650, right after Boston was settled, right after Plymouth was settled, 1770, right around the Revolution, and 1850 in the heart of the Industrial Era and just before the Civil War. So if you look at cataclysmic Western civilization events or important events, they all tend to circulate around those dates. And the Little Ice Age brought colder winters to portions of Europe and North America, and in the mid-17th century, glaciers in the Swiss Alps advanced, gradually engulfing farms and crushing entire villages. So you can see that because it got colder, glaciers moved forward and they swallowed up some towns. Now, if we look at sunspots, these are magnetic storms. I like to say that they're liver spots on the sun. We're all you know, we age day by day, and so does the sun. The sun is a medium to late-aged star. And there are periods of solar activity where there are a lack of sunspots. And when there's a lack of sunspots, it seems that we get extreme weather conditions here on Earth. And the first lack of sunspot data was known as the Maunder Minimum, which began roughly 1650 to about 1720s. And some people attribute this, myself included, that there was a lack of data to support this. And I think that's a little drastic if you look at that graph, the way it drops off. After all, this was after Galileo had been called before Pope Urban VIII in the Roman Inquisition and confined to house arrest because he dared to say that the sun was the center of the solar system, where he was supporting Nicholas Copernicus's idea. So this resembled the earlier Maunder Minimum, about 1645 to 1717, that was responsible for at least 70 years of abnormally cold weather in the Northern Hemisphere. And the Maunder Minimum interval is sandwiched within an even better known cool period known as the Little Ice Age, which lasted from about the 14th through the 19th centuries. Now, if you look at sunspot observations, you have something else known as the Dalton Minimum. And the Dalton Minimum factors into our story here this morning. The Dalton Minimum was a low period of sunspot activity, although in the year 1816, there were plenty of sunspots such that people could see them with the naked eye. But 1816 marked the midpoint of one of the sun's extended periods of low magnetic activity. And this particular minimum lasted from about 1790 to the 1820s. So when we get to the year 1815 and 1816, they're actually on the upslide of the graph, okay, that sunspot activity is pronounced. And that's when you have extreme weather, when the sun is dormant and then all of a sudden comes to life and starts sending off these magnetic storms. And we're going to take a look at that in just a moment. So what's this graph you're saying? Well, this is the sun's movement throughout our solar system. Now, the sun, as you know, we have planets circling the sun. We're part of a galaxy, and the galaxy is moving throughout the universe in an elliptical orbit, and the sun is actually being moved in our solar system, so its place doesn't stay permanently fixed. And there are two large planets that pull that away. Does anybody know what those two large planets are? Yeah. Jupiter and Saturn move the sun. So you'll see that graph just shows the sun's constantly doing a dance within our solar system. So we're farther away at some points from the sun than we would be in other years, and closer in still other years. So during the Dalton and the Maunder Minimum, the sun shifted its place in the solar system, something it does roughly every 178 to 180 years. And during this cycle, the sun moves its position around the solar system's center of mass. This is known as inertial solar motion. Scientists have not yet confirmed whether or not it affects Earth's climate directly, but it is a possibility. So this is one of the three factors: sunspots, the movement of the sun in the solar system, and volcanic activity. Again, here's another graph that shows you about the wobbling sun. And again, because of the gravitational pull of the planets, mostly Jupiter and Saturn, the sun performs a dance around the solar system's center of gravity, known as inertial solar motion. The sun moves around the solar system's center of mass, it's known as the barycenter, in cycles that repeat themselves every 178 to 180 years. And important barycenter shifts took place in 1632, back to again the Pilgrims in Boston, 1811, that's during the War of 1812, and just prior to the period where we're talking about today, and in 1990. And these shifts precede some of the weakest sunspot activity periods ever recorded. As I mentioned, the Maunder Minimum from 1645 to 1715, and the Dalton Minimum from 1795 to 1823. And depending upon who you speak with, those years will shift plus or minus 10 years. So the question is, could the movement of the sun in our solar system impact weather as distances to the Earth increase and decrease? That's the question we have to ask. Okay. Now, what about sunlight? Well, sunlight may be recorded using the sunshine recorder, a pyranometer, or a pyrheliometer. There'll be a quiz for that. The World Meteorological Organization defines sunshine as direct irradiance from the sun measured on the ground of at least 120 watts per square meter. Direct sunlight brings infrared, visible, and ultraviolet light. Bright sunlight provides luminous of approximately 100,000 candles in a square meter. So 100,000 candles in a square meter. And sunlight is a key factor in photosynthesis, which is a process crucially important for life on Earth. Now, what's solar irradiance? Irradiance, radiant emittance, and radiant exudance are radiometry terms for the power per unit area of electromagnetic radiation at a surface. Stay with me. Irradiance is used when the electromagnetic radiation is incident on the surface. Radiant exudance, or radiant emittance, is used when the radiation is emerging from the surface. And I have absolutely no idea what that means. And that's it for the tech talk, okay? Now we can have the fun. So that's just a graph showing solar irradiance. And if you look at that again, from about the year 1651 through about 1701, sunshine hitting the ground was minimal. Sunspots. All right. Sunspot populations quickly rise and more slowly fall on an irregular cycle of about every 11 years. So again, if we take a sunspot cycle of every 11 years to 1816, it's just at the end of a dormant cycle and the beginning of a sharp cycle. And also, the sun's movement of 180 years, that's also moving in a parallax away from the Earth. So you're having the sun moving away from the Earth and you have a lot of sunspots. I have to get through this to get to the good stuff, folks. Over the last decades, the sun has had a markedly high average level of sunspot activity. It was last similarly active over 8,000 years ago. So this past decade, beginning about 1998 and ending in 2007, had remarkable sunspot activity. But that was until 2008 and 2009, when sunspot activity dropped off dramatically. We are waiting for what's known as solar cycle 24 to begin. And basically, if you see the graph, the sunspots, where are they? Nobody knows where they are. And this is why I'm a bit alarmed. When I look at where we are today, okay, in terms of where the sun's position in the solar system is, we are farther away from the sun today as we are at the tail end of that 180-year period. We are also at a sunspot minimum. And we have something known as global dimming due to pollution particles aloft. And you're going to see when the volcano goes off in 1815, that's also putting ash in the upper atmosphere. So those three factors that made that terrible summer of 1816, I also see them play right now as we speak. Frightening. A quick history of solar observation. Apparent references to sunspots were made by Chinese astronomers in about 28 BC, who probably could see the largest sunspot groups when the sun's glare was filtered by windborne dust from the various Central Asian deserts. I will comment right now. Brown clouds come from Asia off the Gobi Desert, and they move to the west off of the Gobi Desert over Europe, and they also block out the sun, causing spectacular sunsets. And there are a lot of dust storms that are happening, not only in China with the Gobi Desert, but also in Australia And to a certain extent in America, we get dust clouds. Not to the extent of the Dust Bowl in the 1930s. But a large sunspot was also seen at the time of Charlemagne's death in AD 813. Sunspot activity in 1129 was first described by John of Worcester, an English astronomer, and Averroes, another astronomer, also provided a description of sunspots in the 12th century. And this is just basically shows you with the magnetic sunspots there. Sunspots are manifestations of solar magnetic activity. In general, the more sunspots there are, the more active the sun is. Ironically, the sun is usually brighter when a larger number of sunspots mar its visible surface. They send out solar flares. This is a drawing that John of Worcester, circa 1129 AD, drew of what he saw of sunspots. And again, we're looking at the top circles there. And that's a large sunspot, if you look at that in relation to the circumference of the sun. Now this guy, I spoke about him earlier, the greatest astronomer ever. He dared to stand up to the church. Early incorrect scientific deductions that John of Worcester had regarding sunspots were corrected and explained by Galileo around 1612. They were first observed telescopically in late 1610 by the English astronomer Thomas Harriot and Frisian astronomers Johannes and David Fabricius, who published a description of sunspots in June of 1611. At the latter time, Galileo had been showing sunspots to astronomers in Rome, and Christoph Scheiner had probably been observing the same sunspots for 2 or 3 months prior to Galileo, and they had a bitter feud, Scheiner and Galileo. Galileo lived from 1564 to 1642. He observed, as I mentioned, sunspots first from Padua, Italy in 1610. Here's a depiction of him up before the Inquisition. He supported Copernicus's view of a heliocentric solar system. And of course, this got him into trouble with his former friend, Pope Urban VIII, and led to a house arrest for the rest of his life after a publicized Roman Inquisition. He observed the surface of the sun at dusk through his telescope, when mist had obscured the glare. He also observed dark spots on its surface and applied a rotation rate of the sun of 25 days. Now, Galileo never went blind due to solar observations. He contracted cataracts and glaucoma in his early 70s. An important man who studied sunspots is named William Herschel, and he discovered Uranus, the planet, on March 13, 1781. And he later discovered two moons of Saturn and two moons of Uranus. But he compiled extensive catalogs of nebulae, which are gaseous clouds, in the universe, and theorized on binary star systems. That's double star systems that rotate around each other. Well ahead of his time. He coined the term asteroid for rogue elements that are traveling throughout our solar system, and he actually discovered infrared radiation. But one thing that he didn't get right, even though he claimed that the sun had an atmosphere, he thought it was full of living creatures, and he made that first proclamation on December 18, 1795. Now, one thing that it's the 150th anniversary of what's known as the Great Solar Flare of 1859. This may be the greatest solar flare that ever hit the Earth. I'm going to talk about one in October of 2003 that was the greatest measured solar flare, but it shot off from the sun and just missed the Earth. Thank goodness. It would have cooked all of our satellites. Your watches would have stopped. There would have been a massive electromagnetic pulse. Well, this massive electromagnetic pulse hit the Earth, and wait till you hear what it did. It was 11:18 a.m. on the cloudless morning of Thursday, September 1st, 1859, when a British 33-year-old astronomer named Richard Carrington, widely acknowledged to be one of England's foremost solar astronomers, sketched some wild magnetic activity on the surface of the sun. And that's his drawing up there. Basically, it's a massive a colony of sunspots. And if you look at that, if you can't see it, but it's basically, it looks about six sunspots welded together. Massive flare. Well, this massive flare, just before dawn the next day, skies all over planet Earth erupted in red, green, and purple auroras so brilliant that newspapers could be read as easily as in daylight. Now, normally, auroras are seen in northern and great southern latitudes near the poles, but these auroras were seen around the equator in the Caribbean, too. So, telegraph systems worldwide went haywire as spark discharges shocked the operators and set the telegraph paper on fire. Even when telegraphers disconnected the batteries powering the lines, aurora-induced electric currents in the wires still allowed messages to be transmitted. So in 1859, you basically have the telegraph in its infancy, about just almost 20 years. Imagine what a massive solar flare would do today to the electronics that they depend on. There are so many people that wouldn't know what to do without electricity. Don't even know how to light a candle. Don't even have candles. There's an aurora there. So solar surface activity impacts Earth's weather and climatology. The explosion produced in 1859 produced not only a surge of visible life, but also a mammoth cloud of charged particles and detached magnetic loops called a coronal mass ejection, or a CME. And it hurled that cloud directly towards Earth. The next morning, when the CME arrived, it crashed into the Earth's magnetic field, causing the global bubble of magnetism that surrounds our planet to shake and quiver. Researchers call this a geomagnetic storm, and rapidly moving fields induced enormous electric currents that surged through telegraph lines and disrupted communications. At the Rocky Mountains, the auroras were so bright, the glow awoke gold miners who began preparing breakfast because they thought it was morning. And there were severe solar geomagnetic storms that have occurred in 1921, that was May 14th, 1960, 2001, and 2003. Now, if you look at that, there's 40 years, right? 40 years, and then 2 years after 2001, we have one. This is why I'm concerned. You're seeing a protracted periods of major storms now. They're becoming shorter, incremental. This is why I'm worried, because the sun's so dormant. I'm worried because there's no sunspots on the sun. I'm waiting for it to blow. It's almost as if where the sunspot activity? We're late with this 11-year cycle. We should have seen a regular, normal occurrence of sunspots on the surface of the sun. There's nothing, not one blemish. And solar astronomers, I'll show you some figures in just a moment, are perplexed. But just again, looking at the international sunspot number, and I'm just going to get up here, and again, if you can't see it, I'll explain. But you can see the natural graph, okay? You can see the increment of sunspots here, and here about is 1816, and that's what caused this massive eruption. But if you look at some of the dates, we've dropped off dramatically since we've come into this decade. And by the way, I just realized 3 months to go in this decade, and it's over. Where'd that go? So the spotless days, okay, in terms of the blankest years, okay, on the face of the sun in the last half century, and again, this is 2008, all the way back to 65, it's the blankest day, and even 2009 is even worse. Astronomers who count sunspots have announced that 2008 is now the blankest year of the space age. As of September 27, 2008, the sun had been blank, i.e. had no visible sunspots, on 200 days of the year. To find a year with more blank suns, you have to go back to 1954, 3 years before the launch of Sputnik, when the sun was blank 241 times. Radio telescopes are recording the dimmest radio sun since 1955. In other words, there's a magnetic echo that comes off of the sun that's measured by radio astronomers, and they're getting nothing. So in 2009, and this is as of last week, or actually this week, September 10th, it was last Thursday, a week ago, there were 202 days without sunspots. That's 80% of the days. And since 2004, there's been 713 days without sunspots, with a typical solar minimum of 485 days. So basically, when the sun goes blank for so long, normally lasts about 485 days over an 11-year period. So if you do the math, you're talking about 45 to 50 days a year. And in 2009, and we still have 3 months to go, is 202 days. So, and that's one of the things to be concerned about. And again, just another graph. The projected count for 2009 will be 299 or 300 spotless days, which will blow away records for the last 200 years. Okay, now do you understand about my concern?
Yeah. Does it affect growing things? Is it a growing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, you're talking about the sun. And when I mentioned sunspots, the sun is brighter because of the solar eruptions. It brings more sunlight, more of that solar irradiance. Remember that nonsense that I was talking about earlier, sunlight hitting the ground. I'm going to show you a data point in just a second about how they measured sunlight and how it correlates with pollution. But anyways, we're waiting for what's known as solar cycle solar cycle 24 to begin. And as you can see, here's what they're predicting now. They're predicting that, wow, we've had such bad solar, we can't get lower than this in 2009, so it's got to go up. And they're right. That's the right assessment. And when we go up here, it's on this incline where things begin to change dramatically. And the Earth adjusts itself. And here, when you have a bright, bright sunset, this where it's going to get really hot. So they're predicting that we're going to have some hot periods near about 2015, about 6 years from now. And again, they were wrong with their last predictions. So it's witchcraft. So let's talk about the year without a summer, which is 1816. And let's look at the sunspots. And that's a photograph of actual sunspots on the surface of the sun. And they're geomagnetic storms, the size of Earth. They were seen with the naked eye in 1816 in the daytime by thousands of people for several days. They didn't have to look straight into the sun. As the sun was setting and you see the beautiful sunsets, they could actually see these black blemishes on the surface of the sun. Very pronounced. Two major periods of sunspots in 1816. The first was May 3rd, 1816, and again on June 11th, 1816. And many attributed the dank weather to the lessening the amount of sunlight that was reaching the Earth. And as I just mentioned, they got it wrong. When you see sunspots, there's actually more sunlight reaching the Earth. And that'll show you the effect of the volcano we'll talk about. And then here's a poem I want to read to you. All ye who tell why stars do wink, come ease my fears. What means this spot that folks may think so strange appears, as if within this ball of fire some hole were dug or something black had settled there, like any bug. That was written in the Connecticut Herald in May of 1816. Now let's go to the volcanoes. We've talked about sunspots. We've talked about the sun's movement in the solar system, and now volcanic eruptions. I've been studying solar astronomy diligently for about 3 years now. One of my favorite books of all time is called The Sun Kings, but whenever I hear about a volcanic eruption, I get nervous. I often tell people that Mother Earth can shake mankind off the Earth like a bad case of the fleas if she wanted to. And how she does that naturally is cooling herself when it gets too hot, as she did when there were dinosaurs on Earth. She spews off some volcanoes. And some major volcanic eruptions in North America took place in the late 18th century. Mount St. Helens blew in the late 1700s. Mount Hood Lava Dome blew in the late 18th century. Laki, Iceland in June of 1783. I'll get to that in a moment. That caused worldwide climatic change. And again, remember, we're only talking about 33 years later when the year without the summer comes. And that Mount Rainier in the 1790s. The Laki Haze. Well, basically, a volcano in Iceland went off in June of 1783. And the following 2 years, 83 and 84, produced the worst winter in the history of North America. It was called Laki-Gígar, Iceland, or Laki-Gígar, Iceland. And it erupted before in 934 to 940 AD, which again parallels with another extreme cooling period on Earth during the Dark Ages, and again on June 8, 1783, and throughout the year of 1784. That's what the volcano looks like. You can see it blew off its top. Looks a little like St. Helens, doesn't it? 120 million tons of sulfur dioxide were emitted, killing plants, livestock, and people, and causing severe weather around the world. In North America, the winter of 1784 was the longest and one of the coldest on record. Record cold beset New England. There was snowfall, record snowfall in New Jersey, the longest freezing of the Chesapeake Bay. There was ice skating in Charleston, South Carolina Harbor. A huge snowstorm hit the South, and the Mississippi River froze at New Orleans. And there was ice in the Gulf of Mexico. It was Benjamin Franklin who first proposed in 1784 that the poor weather could be attributed to a volcanic eruption in Iceland. Quote, this is what Franklin says. During several of the summer months of the year 1783, when the effect of the sun's rays to heat the earth in these northern regions should have been greater, there existed a constant fog all over Europe. They called it a dry fog. And a great part of North America. This fog was of permanent nature. It was dry, and the rays of the sun seemed to have little effect towards dissipating it, as they easily do a moist fog arising from the water. They were indeed rendered so faint in passing through it that when collected in the focus of a burning glass, they would scarce kindle brown paper. So you couldn't even set brown paper on fire with the sunlight with a magnifying glass. The cause of this universal fog is not yet ascertained, or whether it was the vast quantity of smoke long continuing to issue during the summer from Iceland, and that other volcano which arose out of the sea near that island, which smoke might be spread by various winds over the northern part of the world, is yet uncertain. So, what about volcanic winters, okay? And these are cold weather caused by volcanoes. These are great volcanic winter events that I've tracked over the past 2,000 years. Actually, let's say 3,000 years. From 1628 to 1626 BC, climate disturbances usually were attributed to the Minoan eruption of the island of Santorini. In the Mediterranean, it's just a cone. And some people try to equate that with Moses parting the Red Sea, that somehow this was a tsunami induced by the eruption of Santorini. Lake Topos, Hatipi eruption, around 180 AD. There was an extreme weather event in Europe in 535 and 536 AD. Famine, crop failure, the breadless year, they called it. There was the great famine of 1315 to 1317 caused by the eruption of Kaharoa, New Zealand. That was throughout Europe. And then in 1452 and 1453, there was also a very cold summer due to the submarine volcano Kauai. In 1600, it's called Huai Napatina. And that's in Peru, and it erupted, causing a famine in Russia from 1601 to 1603. And then there was something known as Krakatoa in 1883. Over 36,600 people died. There was 5 years of cold weather, including in the Northeast, the blizzard of 88, which crippled New York City. There were two great blizzards that year. A very monumental weather year. And then 1991, Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines. The years 1991 through the years 1993 were cooler than average, and they produced spectacular sunsets. Now, Mount Tambora, that we're going to talk about today, was a stratovolcano in Sumbawa, Indonesia, and it became highly active in 1812 and erupted on April 10th and 11th, 1815. So Tambora blows its top, and there's a satellite picture. You can see how it's gouged out in the very middle of that photo. That's a pretty large crater. And all that dirt's got to go somewhere. Where'd it go? That dust went up into the upper atmosphere. Well, they think that the volcano was formed about 57,000 years ago. And this ash cloud, I'm just going to get up one moment, that when Tambora blew in 1815, it sent ash right across Indonesia into Sumatra, Borneo, and Makassar, killing people in its wake. People choked to death on the sulfuric oxide. There are ancient eruptions that took place there, 6,000 years ago, 3910 BC, again in 3050 BC, and again in 740 AD. The first eruption took place on April 5th, 1815. Thunder was heard from 250 miles away, but the major blast on April 10th was heard from 1,600 miles away and was thought to be the sound of firing cannons. It was about 7 o'clock on April 10th, 1815, when the eruptions intensified. Three columns of flame rose up and merged, and the whole mountain was turned into a flowing mass of liquid fire. Pumice stones of up to 20 centimeters, that's about 8 inches in diameter, started to rain down at approximately 8 o'clock at night, followed by ash at around 9 to 10 o'clock. Hot pyroclastic flows cascaded down the mountain to the sea on all sides of the peninsula, wiping out the village of Tambora. Loud explosions were heard until the next evening. The ash veil had spread as far as West Java and South Sulawesi. Four times larger this eruption was than Krakatoa in 1883. And this is what Sir Thomas Raffles said. The noise was, in the first instance, almost universally attributed to distant cannon, so much so that a detachment of troops were marched from Jakarta into the expectation that a neighboring post was attacked. And along the coast, boats were in two instances dispatched in quest of a supposed ship in distress. So they thought there was a battle going on, and they raised an army and sent their ships to sea. Pitch darkness was observed as far away as 370 miles from the mountain summit for up to 2 days. It was dark. Pyroclastic flows spread at least 12 miles from the summit. All vegetation on the island was destroyed. Uprooted trees mixed with pumice ash washed into the sea and formed rafts of up to 3 miles across. So the trees were knocked down, 3-mile-wide rafts of trees, and some of them floated all the way to India. Clouds of thick ash still covered the summit on April 23, 1815. Explosions ceased on the 15th of July, although smoke emissions were still observed as late as the 23rd of August, 1815. And flames and rumbling aftershocks were reported in August of 1819, a full 4 years after the event. A moderate-sized tsunami struck the shores of various islands in the Indonesian archipelago on April 10th with a height of up to 13 feet in Sangar at around 10 p.m. Now, you remember the Christmas Eve tsunami in Indonesia. That wasn't 13 feet. That was 8 feet. A tsunami of 3 to 6 feet in height was reported in Basuki, East Java, before midnight, and one 6.5 feet tall in the Molucca Islands. By the way, that photograph, I'm going to go back. I just want to show you this photo. That's what the sky looked like after Mount Pinatubo blew in Hong Kong and Southeast Asia. You can just see the dust in the air. The eruption column reached the stratosphere. The stratosphere is at an altitude of more than 140,000 feet. Doing the math, you're talking almost 30 miles high. The coarser ash particles fell 1 to 2 weeks after the eruptions, but the finer ash particles stayed in the atmosphere from a few months up to a few years at an altitude of 33,000 to 100,000 feet. So again, we're talking today about the year without a summer, which is 1816, okay? And this volcano blows in 1815. So it took a full year for the longitudinal winds to spread these fine particles around the globe, creating optical phenomena and altering climatic conditions. So prolonged and brilliantly colored sunsets and twilights were frequently seen in London, England, between June 28th and July 2nd, 1815, and on September 3rd and October 7th, 1815. Spectacular sunsets. And again, back to 1991 through 1993, Mount Pinatubo, there were majestic sunsets seen throughout New England. The glow of the twilight sky typically appeared orange or red near the horizon and purple or pink above. About 75,000 people died. The estimated number of deaths varies depending on the source. 10,000 direct deaths probably were caused by pyroclastic flows. If you look at Pompeii, you've heard about Pompeii, 79 AD. People were literally encased in ash as they were pouring wine, as they were baking bread. They had no chance to react. The same thing happened here in Indonesia. On Sumbawa Island, there were 38,000 deaths alone due to starvation, and another 10,000 deaths occurred due to disease and hunger on Lombok Island. So what do you get first when you have bad growing seasons? You get starvation, then you get disease. So sulfur poured into the stratosphere, causing a global climate anomaly, or they call it a GCA. In the spring and summer of 1816, a persistent dry fog was observed in the northeastern United States. The fog reddened and dimmed the sunlight, such that sunspots were visible to the naked eye. Neither wind nor rainfall dispersed the fog. Average global temperatures decreased by about 0.7 to 1.3 degrees Fahrenheit, enough to cause significant agricultural problems around the globe. So you just move the global temperature in a region 1 degree and you've got problems. 1816 was the second coldest year in the northern hemisphere since AD 1400. After 1601, following the 1600 Huayna Putina eruption in Peru. The 1810s, okay, are the coldest decade on record, a result of Tambora's 1815 eruption and other suspected eruptions somewhere between 1809 and 1810. So with a cooler summer, parts of Europe experienced a stormier winter. This pattern of climate anomaly has been blamed for the severity of typhus epidemic in Southeast Europe and the Eastern Mediterranean between 1816 and 1819. Much livestock died in New England during the winter of 1816 and 1817. Cooler temperatures prevailed and heavier rains resulted in failed harvests in the United Kingdom. Families in Wales traveled long distances as refugees begging for food. Famine was prevalent in North and Southwest Ireland, and again, this is before the major famine of the 1840s, following the failure of wheat, oat, and potato harvests. The crisis was severe in Germany, where food prices rose sharply. Due to the unknown cause of the problems, again, they didn't know why the weather was changing. They didn't attribute it to the volcano. They recognized this fog, but they didn't know where it came from. Well, there were demonstrations in Germany in front of grain markets, bakeries. There were riots, arson, looting in many European cities. It was the worst famine of the 19th century. What about the helpers before Tambora? Well, it wasn't just Tambora that caused this temperature change. There were a number of volcanic eruptions that took place prior to Tambora. 1812, La Soufriere on St. Vincent in the Caribbean blew. Also in 1812, Awu on the Sangihe Islands in Indonesia blew. 1813, Ryukyu Islands, Japan, volcano blew. 1814, Mayon in the Philippines blew. The results, these other eruptions had already built up a substantial amount of atmospheric dust prior to the eruption of Mount Tambora, the largest in 1600 years. And as is common following a massive volcanic eruption, temperatures fell worldwide because less sunlight passed through the atmosphere. Pretty simple, right? If you block out the sun, it's not getting to the earth. And that's, again, why I'm worried about all the pollution now. It's almost as if volcanoes went out because it's blocking out the sunlight, a phenomenon known as global dimming, and I'm going to reference that in just a moment. Historian John D. Post has called this the last great subsistence crisis in the Western world. The unusual climatic aberrations of 1816 had the greatest effect on the northeastern United States, New England, where we are, the Canadian Maritimes, Newfoundland, and Northern Europe. Typically, the late spring and summer of the northeastern U.S. and southeastern Canada are relatively stable. Temperatures average of both day and night average about 68 to 77 degrees Fahrenheit and rarely fall below 41 degrees Fahrenheit. Summer snow is an extreme rarity, though May flurries sometimes occur. I remember seeing a May snow flurry.
I have up in Maine.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Oh, I'm talking Boston.
Okay.
1977. In China, the cold weather killed trees, rice crops, and even water buffalo, especially in northern China. Floods destroyed many remaining crops. And again, just not to give you a weather lesson, but when you have particles aloft, water vapor condenses, forms clouds, more rainstorms. Okay, so you're going to get less sunlight, more rain. It compounds its problem. Mount Tambora's eruption disrupted China's monsoon season, their natural monsoon cycle, resulting in overwhelming floods in the Yangtze Valley in 1816. In India, the delayed summer monsoon caused late torrential rains that aggravated the spread of cholera from a region near the river Ganges in Bengal to as far as Moscow. So with the monsoon season comes winds and it blows it out to sea or blows it to another region on the earth. 1816 and near froze to death. In May 1816, frost killed off most of the crops that had been planted in New England. In June, two large snowstorms in eastern Canada and New England resulted in many human deaths. Nearly a foot of snow was observed in Quebec City in early June, with consequent additional loss of crops. Now, the result was regional malnutrition, starvation, epidemic, and increased mortality. In short, famine. In July and August, lake and river ice were observed as far south as Pennsylvania. Rapid, dramatic temperature swings were common, with temperatures sometimes reverting from normal or above normal summer temperatures as high as 95 degrees Fahrenheit to near freezing within hours. And I'm going to read a section to you about that in Salem, where there's 40 degree temperature fluctuation changes overnight. Even though farmers south of New England did succeed in bringing some crops to maturity, maize and other grain prices rose dramatically. Those areas suffering local crop failures had to deal with the lack of roads in the early 19th century, which prevented easy importation of bulky foodstuffs. In the ensuing bitter winter of 1817, when the thermometer dropped to 26 degrees Fahrenheit, the waters of New York's Upper Bay froze so hard that horse-drawn sleighs were driven across Buttermilk Channel from Brooklyn to Governor's Island. In eastern Switzerland, the summers of 1816 and 1817 were so cool that an ice dam formed below a tongue of the Gietro Glacier high in the Val de Bagnes. In spite of the efforts of the engineers to drain the growing lake, the ice dam collapsed catastrophically in June of 1818, killing hundreds. And this is something I've studied recently. There were luminous electrical snowstorms known as thunder snow in Vermont in January and February of 1817, where ball lightning shocked many people. So still, with that dust aloft, still creating electrical discharges, and again, coupled with the sunspots, you've got electromagnetism going in the Earth's upper atmosphere, and it, people were getting shocked by ball lightning. And that's unprecedented. Throughout the annals of New England weather, I've never seen a case like that outside of January and February of 1817 in northern Vermont. Many New England farmers were wiped out, and tens of thousands struck out for the richer soil and better growing conditions of the upper Midwest, which was then called the Northwest Territory. So you saw a migration of farmers from New England. A lot of orchards were killed. We lost orchards in New England due to the year without a summer in 1816. And again, in eastern Massachusetts, the Middlesex tornado, which took place on August 22nd, 1851, went right through the heart of all the peach, apple, and pear orchards of eastern Mass, and it basically knocked out New England as the cider capital of the world. So Tambora erupted in 1815, so why wasn't the summer of 1815 rather than the summer of 1816 the year without a summer? Answer, there's a time lag between a volcanic eruption and a change in weather patterns caused by the length of time needed for stratospheric winds to distribute the volcanic dust particles around the world. Europe was still recuperating from the Napoleonic Wars, remember, okay? He had just scorched through Europe. In fact, he had burnt Moscow to the ground 2 years earlier. And they suffered from food shortages, not only from the war, but also from the weather. Food riots broke out in Britain and France, and grain warehouses were looted. The violence was worst in Switzerland, where famine caused the government to declare a national emergency. Huge storms, abnormal rainfall with floodings of the major rivers of Europe, including the Rhine, are attributed to the event, as was the frost setting in during August of 1816. Now, I just want to call your attention. When we get my wife got an orange from South Africa the other day. South Africa was the stamp. How much did that cost to get that to my kitchen table? And we're so dependent upon, I call it bulk on demand. And this generation here, oh, it's always going to be there. Some of you have lived through the Depression, so you know what it's like not to have a little and to get by. But I'm not talking about the greed. It's just that they don't know any other way of having the oranges and the apples. And we see during winter storms how the store shelves go dry, and the poor cows are walking like cowboys for the next 3 months. But I often wonder, what happens when that shuts down, when my oranges don't come from South America, my bananas don't come from Colombia, my coffee doesn't come from Mexico or Colombia? Something to think about. A BBC documentary using figures compiled in Switzerland estimated that fatality rates in 1816 were twice that of average years, given an approximate European fatality total of 200,000 deaths. So the year without a summer took 200,000 lives. The lack of oats to feed horses may have inspired the German inventor Karl Drais to research new ways of horseless transportation, which led to the invention of the Draisine or velocipede, which is the ancestor of the modern bicycle. This is by the famous painter Turner, J.M.W. Turner. And look at the sky. And do you know why? Because high levels of ash in the atmosphere led to unusually spectacular sunsets during the period that Turner was most active. And this is a feature that was celebrated in most of his paintings. It's been theorized that this is what gave rise to the yellow tinge that's predominant in this painting, known as the Chichester Canal, circa 1828. The crop failures of the year without a summer forced the family of Joseph Smith to move from Sharon, Vermont to Palmyra, New York, precipitating a series of events culminating in the publication of the Book of Mormon and the founding of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The chemist Justus von Liebig, who had experienced the famine as a child in Darmstadt, Germany, later studied the nutrition of plants and introduced mineral fertilizers. So he said, how can we help these plants grow? And he looked into the advent of fertilizers. Near Iceland, sea ice persisted into June of 1816. The grapes in the Champagne district of Verdun froze in the cold summer and never ripened. Vineyards across France suffered a similar fate. Only a few grapes ripened in the autumn months. The 1816 grape harvest of France was practically non-existent due to the cold summer. And Ireland experienced persistent cold rain for 142 of 153 summer days. In response to the food shortage caused by the year without a summer, the British government abolished income taxes in the year 1816. In January 1816, a blizzard of brown snow hit Hungary. Describing as flesh-colored, the snow's unusual color was the result of mixing with the volcanic dust from Mount Tambora. In the spring of 1816, Hungary and Italy experienced brown, red, and yellow snow, respectively. The food shortage in Canada aggravated a trade dispute over pemmican, a concentrate of meat, berries, and fat between Hudson's Bay Company and the Northwest Company. This triggered the June 1816 Battle of Seven Oaks, in which 24 people died. In Madrid, temperatures were below 15 degrees Celsius in July and August, and that autumn the Catalan peaks of Montserrat and Mont Saint-Denis were covered with snow and the Llobregat River froze over. Now, it also forces people, bad weather forces people indoors, right? Well, let's cut over to Switzerland. Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin Shelley, okay, born in 1797, died in 1851. She married romantic poet, philosopher Percy Bysshe Shelley in 1816. This is after the writing contest. He had been having an affair with her while he was still married when they began their courtship. His wife, Harriet, later tragically committed suicide. Her parents, and I often think she's 18 and 19 years old when she writes Frankenstein. And now look at this marvelous work. Where is this teenage girl, this debutante, getting this amazing story? And then I look back in her heritage. Well, her parents were political philosopher William Godwin, and her mother was the philosopher feminist Mary Wollstonecraft. Good gene pool there. A lot going on upstairs. In 1816, Percy Bysshe Shelley and Mary Shelley, they had not yet married, spent a summer with the poet Lord Byron, author John William Polidori, and Claire Claremont. Now, Byron was having an affair with Claire Claremont. So let's call a spade here. You had Shelley with his mistress, and you had Byron with his mistress. At Byron had Villa Diodati in the village of Colony in Lake Geneva, and Percy Bysshe Shelley and Mary Shelley were nearby in Maison Chapuis. So they're in Switzerland on Lake Geneva, and they arrive on May 14th, 1816, where Mary called herself Mrs. Shelley. Lord Byron would join them just about 11 days later on the 25th of May. Well, they passed the time writing, boating, and talking late into the night. Mary said, quote, "It proved a wet, ungenial summer, and incessant rain often confined us for days to the house." Amongst other subjects that the conversation turned to were the experiments of the 18th century natural philosopher and poet Erasmus Darwin, who was said to have animated dead matter, and to the feasibility of returning a corpse or assembled body parts to life. So that's where she gets the idea. Sitting around a log fire at Byron's villa, the company also amused themselves by reading German ghost stories, prompting Lord Byron to suggest that they each write their own supernatural tale. Shortly afterwards, in a waking dream, according to Mary, Mary conceived the idea for Frankenstein. Quote, "I saw the pale student of unhallowed arts kneeling beside the thing he had put together. I saw the hideous phantasm of a man stretched out, and then, on the working of some powerful engine, show signs of life and stir with an uneasy, half-vital motion. Frightful must it be, for supremely frightful would be the effect of any human endeavor to mock the stupendous mechanism of the creator of the world." And thus she begins writing what she assumed would be a short story, turns into the novel Frankenstein. Well, Percy Shelley encourages her, and she expands this short story into her first novel, known as Frankenstein, or The Modern Prometheus, first published 2 years later in 1818. She later described that summer in Switzerland as the moment when I first stepped out from my childhood into life. And meanwhile, one of the other guys participated in this writing contest, author John William Polidori, wrote The Vampire during that session. So you get a lot of horror coming out of the year without a summer in that one writing session. And here's, I'm going to just read a recording artist named Rasputina last year wrote a song about the year without a summer, and I'm not going to sing it to you and drive you out of the room quicker than I did with that irradiance talk. In the spring of 1815, there began an era of unpredictable weather. It did not lift until 1851. You remember 1816 as the year without a summer. June 1816, a sudden snowstorm blankets all the countryside. So Mary Shelley had to stay inside and she wrote Frankenstein. Oh, 1816 was the year without a summer. Grain couldn't ripen under these conditions. It was brought indoors in urns and pots. It'd go from 95 degrees to freezing within hours, a brutal struggle for the people and the starving livestock. During the most severe years of this little ice age, we looked for scapegoats to blame. Many people tried to blame it all on a vast Freemason conspiracy or Benjamin Franklin and his experiments with electricity. Some did actually blame Franklin. The eruption of the volcano Tambora blanketed the earth with ash. That was a real cause discovered by some explorer years later looking back at the past. I will give you my red color to take away your sickly pallor. For you and so very choleric of complexion, please beware the morning sun and all dejection. 1816 was the year without a summer. In New England, the summer of 1816 included some early June snow, cold nights in both July and August. There was frost measured in New England during that summer almost every day. The widespread frost at low levels, low-level sites around New England, so in valleys, on the 8th and 9th of July, and the damaging frosts of the 22nd of August from interior New England all the way south into North Carolina. So if you were near the Green Mountains, near the White Mountains in a valley area, or even near the Berkshires, you were going to get frost, and it would kill your crops. There were droughts, too. And finally, killing frosts in September, such as that, is September 27th in New England. And a lot of farmers held out waiting for a few more weeks of sunlight, and frost killed their crop. This all led to crop failures and food shortages and helped stimulate a move westward the following year. In both Connecticut and in parts of New York State, frosts after April are rare, but in 1816, frosts were recorded every month of the year. Summer temperatures were slightly below average and 3 to 5 degrees below average, depending upon who you believe. The most severe cold snap came in early June and killed a vegetable crop in parts of New England, ruining some farmers. The worst of the weather was in northern New England, but conditions during the summer were also summer-like at times. For example, a late June heat wave saw temperatures top 32 degrees C between the 22nd and 24th of June. You're talking about 95 degrees Fahrenheit. So you had frost at the beginning of the month, okay? But you're 32 degrees, you're talking a 60-degree differential. And temperatures were near normal for much of the first two-thirds of August. So it looked like they were coming out of it in August. And then it should be pointed out that since 1816 has been just as cold or even colder in each of the summer months, but never in consecutive months. The most notorious part of the infamous summer of 1816 was the cold snap in early June. June began promising enough, and on the 5th, temperatures in New England climbed into the low 30s, that's the 90s. In Salem, Mass., it was 94 degrees. However, during the afternoon of the 5th, okay, thundery showers broke out over New England, and later in the day, a cold front swept across the region, dragging in cold air down from Canada in its wake. The next day, June 6th, was much colder. Some places were as much as 27 degrees colder, that's Celsius, so you're talking almost 60 degrees colder than the day before, and in parts of Vermont and in Boston, temperatures reached little more than 7 degrees Celsius, which is about 44 degrees Fahrenheit. Conditions turned colder during the next 2 or 3 days, and precipitation that fell became increasingly wintry in nature, sleet. Sleet in June. On June 7th, snow fell over the northern highlands of New England. Snow flurries fell in parts of Connecticut and Massachusetts, including Salem, Newton, and Boston Common, and away from the coast, snow fell in June as far south as 42 degrees north. Near Danville, Vermont, snowdrifts just over 50 centimeters high were reported. Talking almost 3 feet high. Contemporary reports spoke of prolonged falls of snow, snow settling and lying for a couple of days, and very windy weather at times. By June 10th and 11th, conditions began to improve, although mornings were still frosty. By June 12th, temperatures were rather more normal and in the 20s or in the 70s and 80s, and there they stayed until the 22nd to the 24th, when something of a heat wave developed. During these 3 days, temperatures around New England widely topped 90 degrees, and on the 23rd, a high of 97 was recorded at Waltham. And on 24th of June, temperatures also reached nearly 97 degrees. The Boston area reached the high 90s as well during that time. But July 1816 was notable for a lack of warm nights, which it turns out are necessary in allowing corn to grow and ripen. Some of the coldest nights were on the 8th and 9th of July, when a light ground frost affected some areas, such as the Upper Connecticut Valley and at Middlebury, Windsor, and Williamstown in Vermont. July 1816 was also a very dry month, and drought began to affect the harvest in some parts of New England. So where you got a lot of rain and frost in northern New England, you had a drought, and you're talking for 3 months without rain. Moving into August, temperatures were normal for the first two-thirds of the month. That was until after the 18th and 19th, where the temperatures were in the 90s, but conditions were dry. So the passage of an active cold front on the 20th of August led to a cooling down and a couple of spells of frosty nights during the last third of the month, which wiped out crops in some northern parts of New England. Contemporary reports mentioned snow-covered mountains in August and dry, cool conditions of late August persisted through September, which ended with a series of crop-killing frosts. Snow flurries were reported on Boston Common on June 7, 1816. On that day, the ground was, quote, white with snow in Newton, Mass. Now, that's the year without a summer, 1816. Let's talk about this summer, if we had one. We had 12 days of 85-degree weather or over, and that was in the last third of August, which was, hey, we put up with, what, 7 months of winter now? Because winter begins November, December, January, February, March, April. April's a winter month, folks. You can't sell me otherwise. But if you look at the records here, and I don't know if you can see this graph, but Massachusetts ranked 27th coldest in the nation, okay? If you look at some records, record cold, there was record cold in Minnesota this summer, Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, Missouri, Iowa, Nebraska, South and North Dakota. Much below normal in Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, Kansas. Look at I know my states. See that just by shape. Arkansas, Alabama, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, Vermont, and Massachusetts. So we were below normal, okay? Now, near normal, Maine, New Hampshire, Connecticut. Above normal, in terms of hotter than usual, Oregon. I was out there at Mount Rainier in Washington, actually, during their heat wave this year, 100 degrees, but in no humidity. Stay out of the sun. There's something to be said for shade. But in above normal was California, Oregon, Arizona, New Mexico, and Louisiana. Much above normal was Texas and Florida, and record warmest was Washington State. They had our summer. They stole our summer. So the Northeast region had its eighth wettest June through August summer on record. By contrast, the South, Southeast, and Southwest regions were drier than average. Arizona had its third driest summer, while both South Carolina and Georgia had their sixth driest summer in 2009. There were more than 300 low-temperature records, counting daily highs and lows, set across the states in the Midwest during the last 2 days of August. For the 2009 summer, the average temperature of 71.7 degrees Fahrenheit was 0.4 degrees Fahrenheit below the 20th century average. So the 2008 average summer temperature was 72.7 degrees Fahrenheit. So we were almost 1 degree cooler as a nation than we were last year. Big deal. A recurring upper-level trough held the June-August temperatures down in the central states, where Michigan experienced its fifth, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and South Dakota their seventh, Nebraska its eighth, and Iowa its ninth coolest summer. By contrast, Florida had its fourth warmest summer, while Washington and Texas experienced their eighth and ninth warmest, respectively. The Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota region experienced its sixth coolest summer on record, and only the Northwest averaged above normal temperatures. So, I'm going to wrap it up with my prediction here. And this is frightening, but here's what I think is going to happen. First of all, let me harken back to what happened on September 11, 2001. After September 11, 2001, all air traffic was grounded. Okay, do you remember the really blue skies we had in September 12, 13, 14? spectacular blue sky. Well, at that time, there was a study being undertaken measuring sunlight reaching the Earth in the United States by some British scientists who were over here. The study began in early September, concluded in late September. And what they noticed during September 12th, 13th, 14th, and into the 15th, is that sunlight reaching the Earth increased by almost 20%. In other words, the airliners that were laying this coat, these contrails up here, deflecting the sunlight back in outer space, they cleared, and more sunlight reached the Earth. Evaporation rates, by the way, and this is true right now. If you have a puddle sitting in your yard, I'll tell you right now, more than 20 years ago, it would have evaporated quicker than it does today. The evaporation rates are down. So here's what my prediction is. And again, I'm not the global warming guy. I'm not the guy who says it's nature. And I try to tell people, enjoy global warming. It's a temporary phenomenon, and it's a precursor to something more drastic and dramatic and irreversible. Here we go. I can tell you folks, you've lived through it all, but I fear for your grandchildren. I don't have children, and I fear for your great-grandchildren. We must stop global warming now to prevent global dimming, which will incite global cooling. I'm going to say that again. We must stop global warming now to prevent global dimming, which will incite global cooling. We keep doing. Global warming is a temporary phenomenon caused by pollution aloft, where sunlight gets in, but it can't get back out. The radiation can't get back out, so it stays within the Earth and warms up the Earth. But after a while, that sunlight's not going to get through that pollution cloud. It's going to be deflected back in outer space. There goes your global warming. It becomes global dimming, which will incite global cooling. And what happens, and here's my theory, science fiction, global cooling, more people are going to burn things, more coal-fired factories, people are going to use their fireplaces, you're going to have smoke chimneys. Instead of that nice smell of wood on a cold autumn day, you're going to see people doing that more and more, and that will just perpetuate the issue. Air pollution will one day block out the sun and quickly bring on a deadly cooling period, causing starvation and disease. There. I said it. It's going to happen. I don't want it to happen. It's not going to happen soon, but it's going to be happening gradually. And I think that this is coupled with the low sunspot activity. And if we see that coming out of that rise with the sunspots, all of a sudden the sun starting erupting, it's going to cause weather changes here, more clouds, more swings, more dramatic weather events. Sunlight reaching the Earth is gradually diminishing due to pollution particles aloft. A study of sunlight was underway in the United States when the 9/11 attacks took place in 2001. With air traffic grounded, scientists noticed a 20% increase in sunlight and water evaporation rates during 3 days of clear skies. So, that is my presentation this morning, folks. And I don't want to leave you that way, but I want to get the message across that we have to do something. We have to do something now, or it's going to be too late. Thank you very much.
A question.
Yes, sir.
My daughter lives in Manhattan on the 17th. Of a building, and she says, "I've seen the most spectacular sunsets I've ever seen." Is that a forecast or something?
POLLUTION. What do we got? We got air pollution. And there's also more. There's been a lot. Yes, she's seen, absolutely. In fact, if the last few nights, last night, a couple of nights ago, spectacular. When you see the pinks and the purple hues, when you see those, that's pollution. But you've got raging dust storms that are coming off the Gobi Desert in China, in fact, and in Australia. So there's more sand particles aloft because there's arid, barren areas that are becoming more and more wasteful, especially in South America when they're killing the rainforests. But there's a little more dirt aloft. We haven't had a high volcanic era, but it's the air pollution. So, yeah, she's seen some really fantastic sunsets, and she'll continue to do so. As she looks to the west, and she's not seeing the noctilucent clouds, which are high-level atmospheric clouds, but yeah, she's seen some spectacular sunsets, absolutely. And it could be where she is due to the pollution added by New York City alone to the upper atmospheric pollution, and that's what's causing it. But yeah, you're right, there have been some spectacular...
Two nights ago, there was a gorgeous...
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
I couldn't believe
right.
what it was.
It was.
It looked like fire, a little bit of fire.
Yeah, God was turning on the TV. Yeah. That's what I said to my wife. I said, you know... But you're right, there are spectacular ones. But let me ask you this, okay? Just about 2009, if we could just go around the table, and your thoughts on this summer, in terms of being cool and wet, and what you remember of other New England summers. And basically, do you think this is one of the worst summers that you've ever experienced weather-wise?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
What about you?
Yeah, I think it's one of the worst.
Yep.
Yeah, I do too.
That's humidity.
The humidity?
Yes, that humid spell was wicked.
Okay.
We had a long spell of humidity.
Yeah. I certainly can't remember a worse June or July than that. And I'm not 50 yet, but I'm not 40. So, what about yourself? What's your opinion on this past summer?
Mine, yeah.
Yes, sir.
The heavy rain in the first part of the year it destroyed the tomato crops, and they got that blossom rot, and they had it, you couldn't eat them, and they disappeared.
Yep. Yep. And we're going to all pay the price, aren't we, the supermarket. I'll tell you what, though. There's some delicious ears of imported corn coming in from the Midwest, but the native corn that we're about to start, I don't know. I started a garden. I grew lettuce, radishes, carrots, tomatoes, and corn. I had 44 corn stalks. I had one ear that big that I harvested. I told my wife, all this work and I get one little chintzy salad. Okay? No radishes. Carrots the size of your fingernail. It's just horrible. Lettuce grew okay. I think I'm going to be a lettuce farmer next year. Right. The herbs grew well. Our basil. We got a nice herb garden. But unless you have constant sunlight, and some of our garden had shade, not even beans. Even the mint, which is a weed, they'll take mints. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay right here, you know. So, but what's your opinion, sir, in this summer?
Well, just something I heard about was a man in this area that has some beehives, and he produces honey. He didn't produce enough honey to take to market because the bees weren't able to get their nectar. Because the blossoms weren't blossoming.
The whole ecosystem, the whole chain collapses.
Yeah.
And it's, again, we need sunlight. Mm-hmm. It's vital to our interests. There are parts of, you know, we shouldn't be, I'll say this and I hate it, but we shouldn't be in the southwestern United States. That's not inhabitable land. And you can build on it and build your golf courses and try to steal the river from California or drill 200 feet down to hit some aquifer. But at the end of the day, Mother Nature made it that way for a reason, that you shouldn't be living there. And you're going to see a mass exodus probably in the next 20 years out of the Southwest, because water will be... water will be, because it's not as temperate as the Northeast, water will be at such a premium that you have to flush your toilet. Yeah, you can't. You have to have your own cistern. So we've got to, reduce our carbon footprint. One thing that's going on in my town of Watertown, which I like to see, and it's normal now, is I'm recycling. And I should have been doing it years ago, but I'm cognizant of the fact of glass cans, plastic bottle, and paper. And we're actually separating it. My wife, you know, urges me to do so. And one of the biggest pollutants, I'm getting off topic here, but that GD bottled water.
Yep, exactly.
Are you kidding me? And no deposit. Everywhere. That's and eventually... there's going to be a huge market in waste reclamation, where people are going to dig up dumps, okay? And they're going to go after that plastic, those cans, because those are precious metals. And you can make pretend that you own gold because you bought a certificate that says you own gold. And like I tell some of my pro athlete friends, I said, where do you keep it? In a safety deposit box, in a vault, buried in the basin? Oh, it's kept by this broker? Yeah, sure it is. There's probably 10 people think they own the same little piece of gold that you do. Another Bernie Madoff waiting to happen. So I guess it, for us, I think that we should appreciate what we have, but we are destroying Gaia, and we're all guilty every time we turn on the TV, every time we turn on the computer. But we can help in our own individual way if we each decrease our own carbon footprint by using less and less electricity, by recycling, by being more smart and appreciative as to what we have. And I think, as I mentioned before, the generation that's running this country, if they can get off the golf course and into their office and act like an executive instead of trying to go chase a white ball, maybe we'd be in a better situation financially here. And then the gimme generation, the me video game generation, wait till they get in charge. Wait until they... All right. Anybody else? Anybody have any opinions? Dick, do you have any opinions on this summer?
Well, I thought... I planted cucumbers and zucchini and all tomatoes and stuff like that, but I thought what was happening was me and the poor land I had, but I guess it was attributable to the weather too.
Yep.
And it was kind of alarming that all the water that I put on that thing and all the seeds that I planted, and I got absolutely zero.
Let me ask you this, Dick. My garden, we have a lot of shade, and I don't mind. I'd rather lose a garden and to have some big shady trees to sit under on a hot night. How's your sunlight? You get a lot of sunlight?
Well, you do. I do. But where I planted the cucumbers and stuff was semi, get some sun, but not a lot of sun. So I guess I contributed to my own unproductivity.
That's what my brother said too, and he's a great gardener, and he grows everything, and everything grows. We have green thumb. This year, he said, I don't know what happened to my green thumb.
It's not him.
Lost. No.
See, and that alarms me when I hear professional gardeners like that, people that know their gardening, horticulture.
Now this was happening. I'll tell them.
Well, it's the sunlight. It's the sunlight, and it's the more cloudy days.
I have a forsythia hedge that grew from all the rain so high I had to have trimmed twice this summer.
Oh, there are plants that thrive on that. There's no doubt. And I mean, we have these invasive species.
And they're weeds, actually.
Oh, yeah. Poison ivy loves it.
Yep.
Ivy loves this type of weather. I mean, if you think of what would grow in Ireland, potatoes, bumper potato crop. There are crops that do thrive in this. Do you have any recollections?
Having lived in Arizona for 35 years, I was used to sun. Mm. And a day without sun was unheard of. Every day, sun. Then I moved here 12 years ago. And this summer, no sun, mostly rain. It was devastating to me. I used to get up in the morning this summer here and put my furnace on. I just flip it up to warm up the house. Never did that in my life before. So this summer was different.
I'm a folklorist. I'm not a scientist. And I'm guessing that perhaps you're going to be seeing more moderate winters in New England. I mean, they just go on and on and on, cold and wet. Not freezing cold so much, but you're going to see more snowstorms sneak up the coast.
Yeah.
But I just think that you're going to see the summers. I told somebody, get used to it. You're going to see these shrinking summers, and as spring is contracted, winter is protracted. I still think this is the best month of the year, September. Yeah. I think we're going to get a nice October. And then November, that first weekend of November, we always get about 60 degrees, and then whammy! Oh, you're going to get it. And so that's what I think. But you are seeing the climate change. And anybody that says it's nature and makes pretend that there's not let's do the math. About 20 billion people have inhabited this planet in the last 250 years. Okay, 20 billion. And that you don't think that they polluted each every one of them. Well, you're not telling the truth.
I just love New England weather.
Well,
the change in is good. It's just not to decline. Now I know it's one of the causes, but I've always enjoyed watching the seasons. You know?
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the benefits you're going to get is you're going to get a spectacular foliage season, the likes that you haven't seen for quite some time. All the rain.
My son-in-law, for the first time, had a terrible garden. Mm. None of his vegetables grew decently or at all. Yeah.
That's scary.
It was scary, and he kept complaining about his soil, and he was buying ingredients to
and
nourish
himself. You wonder about the plight of the farmers.
There you go. There you go.
They had a terrible, terrible season. Now you know why tomatoes cost $1.98 a pound.
Now, with this economic crisis, which, by the way, I think we're in the top of the third inning.
Hopefully.
No. We're talking personally.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's going to go well into the next decade.
Oh, God.
Well into the next decade, and the currency will not be the dollar. But that's another lecture on another day. What you're seeing here is the farmers who are suffering. But I tell people that, you know, worldwide, not talking about a blight such that affected potatoes in Ireland in 1814, but you have this prolonged drought and famine, and there's not enough tomatoes for everybody. There's not enough wheat for everybody. And I often say that our most prized asset in America are our grain fields, the breadbasket. And if the Dust Bowl, which is an anomaly that wasn't seen for the likes of 300 years based on Anglo-Saxon data, the devastation that that caused in the southern Midwest, lifting topsoil up and spreading it and altering the climate as well, what if that returns? Then where do you go? Right? There's only so many cans of SpaghettiOs and boxes of Rice-A-Roni.
How about breathing air?
Well, the air quality certainly is poor. You know, and you're seeing heightened rates of emphysema. Certainly, yes. And that just goes because of toxin pollutants. And again, that's the industrial boys who bought off some inspector, like that clown that caught sleeping on the job, and they're emitting toxic particles into the upper atmosphere. And of course, we're ingesting them as we breathe, right, with our respiration. So. I wish I could leave you with some positive news, but again, I try to go to church every day, and my CEO's up there, so, and hopefully we get through this. But
despite all this, John, we're all living longer.
Yep.
Which you would think it would be going in the opposite direction, with the pollution and all the things that have happened in this country. Why are we living longer?
Well, some of these cholera we've defeated, polio.
Yep.
Yeah, but other things must be creeping in too.
Oh, well, they talk about the swine flu thing that's coming in. I keep hearing about it, and I had a terrible pneumonia this past March with my wife. We both, and I'm frightened now. I'm vulnerable, and I'm a middle-aged guy. But I thought that I had a good, strong constitution, so
you're
I'm worried.
Middle-aged, John. You're a young man.
There you go.
The way we look at it.
Well, you know, now that's my dad is on, 11 prescriptions, and he went to Europe and forgot 9 of them. And he says, I never felt so good. But I'm not a doctor, but it's just because you have one doctor, they don't know how that interacts with that. And you have this doctor, and my brother's a doctor, and he says, I diagnose him and pill him, and then I think about it. So, I mean, that's, you know.
I think you're right on this plastic water bottle, though.
Oh, it's
everywhere.
Right,
plastic water.
Right. And it was all tap water. Joke's on you.
It's
not spring water. The joke is on you. And what the best thing to do is, and again, some tap water is horrible, but we have these filters on the faucet, and we refill our plastic bottles.
Yeah. But they say you shouldn't do that.
Oh, that, you know who's saying that? The makers of Dasani water and Poland Spring, so you buy more. That's who's saying that. So, well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. This is very interesting. You know, you were talking about the airplanes. You know, there's so much talk about trying to do something with the automobiles. Mm. But have they ever talked about doing anything with the airplanes? I never hear anything of that.
Is there anything they can do? Well, first, like I said, the flights that are going cross-country with 6 people in them, eventually some accountant's going to say, wait a minute, we're not making a profit here.
Right.
And then they made it, I don't know about you, but I don't want to fly unless I absolutely have to because they treat me like a terrorist when I go to the airport. And some person that doesn't even speak English, he's got a plastic glove, wants to do things to me. And I can't bring shampoo, heaven forbid. And, you want to run my Social Security number, see if I have a record? Fingerprint. I don't have any problem with anybody knowing my public record, but I only fly if I have to. People with this economic crisis, when gas is going to go to $4 a gallon, not because there's not a lot of it, because they decided they wanted to go to $4 a gallon, you'll see flights cut down. You're seeing flights eliminated. Airlines will fold up.
Because of the economy.
That's right. And again, people like to mention this thing called socialism, but when you have a bad economic environment, and I try to tell people this, and this is bad, but here we go. At the end of communism comes capitalism via socialism. At the end of capitalism via socialism comes communism. And what I mean is that the government, in order for this country to stay alive, is going to have to buy up industries. They'll probably buy up rail. They'll probably buy up airlines. And there'll be one airline probably run by the government. That's just the natural economic evolution. And that's right. The competition will be done by there won't be competition because it'll be one big whale, one oligarch like they had in Russia that takes over the entire industry. And maybe, Walmart I thought was going to be that big beast, but maybe there's a bigger gorilla that's going to swallow up your Walmarts and corner the market.
In other words, enjoy every minute that you have.
Yep.
That's right.
Yep. Okay.
That's right. Thanks, everybody.
Well, thank you, John. That's very, very interesting. And what is your next thing that you'll be